big lie, referring to the official story. It's nothing but an absolute bald-faced lie from opening syllable to final period or whatever ends the official statement. I mean, it is really an outrageous lie, and it is the big lie of our time. And everything that's happened over the last dozen years is a result, well, the big stuff that's happened is a result of that day and the lie that resonated. And that's a lie that needs to be corrected. But Peter, talk a little bit about 9/11 and your ideas about it.
Yeah, sure. First of all, I'd like to tell you it's a beautiful late summer's day here in England. Gorgeous day. It's been gorgeous all week. As you know, I'll be starting my international travels again soon. Don't know where I'll end up, but I shall be doing what I always do best, and yeah, I will end up in Australia, there's no doubt about that. I have to go through Latin America and through the States, actually, at one stage. Anyway, 9/11, yes, the greatest illusion ever. Even Houdini, in all his glory, could not have pulled that one off any better.
Houdini became absolutely...
I've said this on your show before, and I'll repeat it again. No matter how much it shocks the people there in the States and anywhere else in the world, no aircraft hit any building in 9/11. Please understand that. No aircraft hit any building. There was no international terrorists. There were terrorists, but there were self-induced terrorists. We don't need to go into that, but I can assure you, being an aviation expert, I've spent my entire life in aviation. I know the aircraft in particular. I know their limitations. I know what happens to the aircraft and the structure when they exceed their never exceed speed. What happens to the engine pods when an alloy aeroplane hits a structure of this substantial size and strength, etc., etc. And you can cross-examine me on that if you want. But that's my first statement, and so go ahead.
Well, and the Pentagon, absolutely no aircraft hit the Pentagon. Dare I say, a cruise missile? Is that probably what hit the Pentagon?
Yes, absolutely. The type isn't known, probably one of the older ones, but certainly a cruise missile. The point of penetration was very, very small, and the fact that it went right through various structures and came out into the center of the Pentagon, an alloy aircraft couldn't achieve that. And upon contact with the structure, made that incredible spiraling turn with the G-forces involved, with, quote, a novice pilot, without scraping the grass or anything. You know, it's just ridiculous. But anyway, it went through the building, which would indicate that it had a penetrator on the warhead, like depleted uranium or something similar. And also what the public probably don't realize is there was some government defense money that had gone adrift. I think it was $2.5 trillion, which Rumsfeld gave reference to, that hadn't been accounted for. And where the missile hit was where the investigation was taking place. So evidence destroyed. And if anyone can remember Rumsfeld's broadcast in relation to the Pentagon, as normal, and he did this many times, as did other people, he said that when the missile struck, and very quickly he turned that from a missile into an aircraft, and even the guy in charge of the investigation board also came out with a missile in his initial rundown on what happened that day.
These guys better get their story straight. I mean, somebody just might end up catching them on these faux pas. Freudian slip, Peter.
Yeah, the problem is, Stephen, when you get an incident of this magnitude, and remember it's an international, worldwide coverage, it's like a Shakespearean play. The only difference is Shakespearean plays are experts at what they do, and they get their lines right, and they're the best of the best. Unfortunately, this Shakespearean play out around the world went terribly wrong. Actors didn't say the right thing at the right time when the prompt boards went up. Even Building 7, if you can recall, was announced by CNN and BBC live on television when it collapsed 20 minutes before it actually came down.
Oh,
that should have been the first clue.
I saw the video. I didn't see it when it was aired, Peter. Building 7 that came down in the afternoon, and nothing struck it. There was no fire. There was nothing. And on its own, around 5 in the afternoon, the Twin Towers came down early in the morning, maybe 8, 9, I think around 9 o'clock in the morning, maybe 9:30 New York time. And on its own, Building 7 came down, and BBC... I forget the precise number of minutes, but it was 20-odd minutes before it happened. BBC and Jane Stanley, the on-air presenter, she will never live that. I don't know what she's doing now, but she'll never live that down for the rest of her life. I don't know how you explain a story like that, Peter.
Well, I suppose you have to ask if she's still alive. You know that most of the people that know what happened that day aren't around anymore. But let's put this thing into true context. Before we come back to the towers, which I can fill you in from the aeronautical aspects, let's just go to the United Shanksville, the heroic fight, you know, this bravado. Almost a film that's flashed across the screen about people on their cell phones when the aircraft was plummeting towards a possible city, and they wrestled with the so-called terrorist and decided to put it nose down into the field in Shanksville. The first thing is, of course, mobile phones don't work when you're up in the air anyway. That's the first clue. The second clue is that the aircraft... did crash, there's no question about that, but there was no heroic fighting. We believe everyone on board was already dead, and unknown to the public, a couple of those aircraft had actually physically been on a sort of a radio-controlled exercise, and they did have apparatus on board, because people were doing experiments as to whether they could control an airliner like they can the drones. And so there's another clue. And the other issue is they went into great detail about this marking in the field where it showed you the slot where the wing apparently entered the ground, and then the tail fin, which they said the plane entered at 45 degrees inverted, i.e. upside down. And so when you look at the slot in the field, the fin is supposed to go off to the right, as it would do if it was inverted. But on the one that they'd done, it was on the left, which means the plane, if it hit the field, was the right way up, even though it was at 45 degree angle. And just to blow that theory out of the sky completely, sorry for using that pun, but that aircraft was actually intercepted and taken out by the National Guard. It was intercepted, it was missiled, and it didn't come down in the field. It was disintegrated over a wooded area, and it actually dismantled the house that was in that location. And there's witnesses to that effect. And the other most important thing of all is that besides those bits coming down in the forest area, there was contact made with that aircraft at one stage, and I'll come into this later in a little bit later on. But what we're looking at here is the National Guard shot the aircraft down, and the commander of that aircraft that fired the missiles, and indeed the squadron, received awards. And that award was broadcast, and there's pictures of the commander of the aircraft receiving a medal, because that's a pretty horrible thing for a pilot to have to do. And of course he was doing it for the sake of the country. The reason why that aircraft was taken out was because NORAD had shut down, but like any big Shakespearean act, somebody did the right thing. NORAD was shut down, but the National Guard still managed to take this aircraft down. So that is the truth with Shanksville. So I'll go back to you before we continue.
Well, absolutely, and there's so much just about that plane alone. My goodness, I mean, some of the flight numbers, as I recall, didn't actually exist. Supposedly, people on that plane made cell phone calls before cell phone technology was able to allow them to make a phone call from an aircraft flying at that height, whatever it was, back to the ground. So what was impossible at that time was reported to have happened. Another lie. So many lies. My God. I mean, we can. Well, David Ray Griffin wrote 10 books on this subject, detailing all of these lies.
The thing is, Stephen, you cannot use a conventional mobile phone. Yes, you can use the aircraft's integrated system, because it's wide to that effect. And of course, that technology came in later. I mean, I go on long haul quite a few times, and you can use your credit card and patch into the aircraft system, which has special aerials, on the aircraft to communicate. It's a sort of a satellite and ground station combination that allows that to happen. A conventional cell phone will not work in an aircraft. Yes, when you're coming in low and touching down, but not at altitude, no way in the world. And so that's a farce. We know that the Pentagon was a farce, except to say that there was an airliner made an approach towards the Pentagon, and if you listen to those very reliable police officers that were interviewed and the people in the cemetery nearby, they said that an airliner of a Boeing type did transit on the other side of the building and then did a spiraling turn and appeared to be possibly climbing out after it had disappeared behind the trees. However, the National Air Transport Safety Board's report said it was to the north of the facility and put it on a totally different track. So there's two gross differentials. And then, of course, there was a guy that came out the back dock where the trucks load up at the Pentagon. He heard an aircraft approaching, went out the back dock, looked up and saw an aircraft overshooting. And he also noticed, as did others, that there was a military aircraft circling overhead, which could well have been some sort of controlling mechanism for the missile. And it goes on. There's so much, and you know about the taxi driver and the post and all that sort of thing. Back to you again.
Takes your breath away, Peter. It's amazing. I'm not much of a movie fan, but the folks that write screenplays or whatever for movies, they have certainly a rather a skilled imagination to come up with all the plots and storylines and so on. But these people are absolutely amateurish compared to the people who wrote the script for the 9/11 event. I mean, this thing, if anybody came into a Hollywood producer with a script like the one they wrote, they would have been thrown out on their ear because nobody would ever believe this kind of a story. But there it is.
We can now go into the more technical aspect. I'll just come back to the Pentagon because this is vital for the public to understand that taking aside a novice pilot with no experience whatsoever on a large aircraft, and there wasn't any terrorists anyway, by the way, but anyway, let's assume there was a terrorist and a novice pilot at the controls. Even the best pilot in the world, and there are people that have given evidence on this that worked with that airline, with both airlines, and with those particular aircraft. And they said that it would be almost physically impossible to do this spiraling descent, rapid descent, on full power, and then with the G-forces, and then skim it along the lawn without touching the lawn. If you've ever seen an aircraft doing a low pass at an air display, on a typical day, you can see that there is movement, and it's a very dangerous maneuver. That's why they are somewhat restricted how low they can come. With the Pentagon, we're talking about something that skimmed inches above the lawn and never touched it and went in. So that was a non-event. Now, the other thing that's, this is vital both for the towers and for the Pentagon, that if it was a Boeing 767 or whatever, it doesn't matter, any airline, it's got to never exceed speed for which it cannot exceed, because then you get a wing flutter, and this happens sometimes. The wings come off in storms and things like that due to structural failures. This is in the older aircraft mainly, but let's assume that it's a new plane. It comes down on a spiraling G-turn on a full power descent, which is required to do the so-called penetration they say happened, and you would get this wing flutter. And when you get wing flutter or any contact, like when it enters the building, people have to understand that the engines themselves have got shear pins or fuse pins, and when there is any vibration in the wing, it's intended to shed that pod, to shed that engine, because it's better to lose the engine and have a smooth aerofoil and just manage the aircraft on the one that's left, if you've got one left, or if you lose both, it will drop both and you just do a free glide and hope for the best. So there is another technicality there. So we'll leave the Pentagon now, and this is the most vital part of all. I'll come to the Twin Towers, but I'll go back to you again just to put your two cents in.
Well, just a couple of comments, Peter. I remember not long after the 9/11 event, I heard about I think it was one specific experienced pilot commenting on the fact that, you know, a plane supposedly coming in at that incredibly low altitude, and the pilot just, you could almost see him shaking his head and saying, I don't know how an experienced pilot could have pulled off anything like this, let alone these amateurs flying a commercial airliner, number one. On the day itself, when I knew absolutely nothing about what was going on, it just seemed like an awfully horrific event that seemed implausible, but, you know, the story said it happened. And I watched, I think it was a replay of the second tower coming down at free fall. And even my non-technical mind, it couldn't compute it. I couldn't understand how any building, no matter how severely damaged, and it was only hit at the top, and the replay, I guess, showed fire at the top of the building. I knew nothing about how much heat is needed to melt steel girders, and the fact that jet fuel doesn't come anywhere near close enough. And this building came down at free fall, and in my mind I said, I mean, how on earth is anything like this possible? It just doesn't compute in my mind. And I wrote a letter, I've said this on air before, I wrote a letter to my brother that night, and I basically said, you know, I don't know what the heck is going on, but I can tell you this, they're drinking champagne in the White House tonight. Little did I know, indeed they were. And then there was so much else, Peter, so quickly after the event. You know, telltale evidence found in convenient places, like so-called terrorists in charge of bringing this down or on the plane, leaving their ID in a identifiable car in an airport parking lot.
Yeah.
I mean, you might as well leave your fingerprints all over the scene of the crime so everybody will know you're responsible. On and on and on this stuff went. I mean, a kind of a scenario that even the game that couldn't shoot straight wouldn't do the kind of stuff these people supposedly, we were told they did. Well, of course, they didn't. They had nothing to do with it. Some of the people supposedly on these planes are still alive and well, Saudi Arabia or wherever they are. And again, I mean, one lie compounded on another lie, on another lie, on another lie. There's so much of it that actually is known now. But every 9/11, the U.S. media especially, Peter, they glorify in honoring the heroes who died on that day, the people who worked in the towers and the brave firemen and so on and so forth. I don't know how these people go to bed at night. I mean, they have to know by now that they're reporting lies. I guess lying pays well, Peter.
Yeah, well, of course, there's still some other technicalities that you have to take into account. And when you've been in aviation all your life, like I have, there are other values that you can look at. And one is when anything is traveling at conventional speed, i.e. a conventional aircraft, even a fighter if it's not going through the sound barrier, racing cars and the like, you can freeze frame the aircraft or the object down to make it go in slow motion and do what it's professed to have done. In this particular case, when the quote missile comes in from the right hand side of the only camera that happened to be working that day, which is another farce, because there was cameras everywhere, and anyone in any inquiry would have made those films available as part of the inquiry, but the public were not to see them. The black box is another big hoax. But anyway, that's a technical issue I won't go into at the moment. But let's just go on the freeze frame basis, because I did this for all the footage that was available for the towers and for the Pentagon. And the Pentagon in particular, if it's traveling at conventional speed, you freeze frame it, you'll capture it, and you'll do it click by click, it slow motion into the building. And you'll see exactly what the object is that hit that building. In this particular case, because it was a missile or something traveling at excessive speed, you can only capture it once before it actually hits the building. So there's the first clue. And then you dump that all together, and now let's move to the Twin Towers. I did the same with the Twin Towers, and I used this example. There was a program on TV called Stargate. I don't know whether everyone ever saw that. An American program where people, there was a big ring of like watery substance, and these people in this program that was on a regular basis would walk through this water and disappear into another world or some future time. And this is exactly how the aircraft disappeared into the towers. It was a hologram or a computer-generated image, because when you freeze-frame it, and this is another situation, that the first aircraft of the day that hit the tower, I think it was the American Airlines one, there was only one ever shot taken, and that was at a very awkward angle at ground level with a fireman testing the hydrant in the street, and then he heard this roar. He looks over his shoulder and bam, in it goes. When you freeze frame that, you can't capture it. What you do capture an image, but it's traveling incredibly fast. So there was an explosion. There could well have been a cruise missile involved. And then we come to the explosion content itself. Jet fuel gives off a sort of a red, brilliant orange, sometimes yellow, indication in the inferno, and that's as hot as it will get. When you see anything of quote thermonuclear structure, that becomes brilliant yellow to white, which shows that the core temperature is in excess of 5,000 degrees, which is very, very hot. And also you get this cascade with DU and nuclear weapons, like fireworks, like sparklers. And if you study that impact, first of all, you'll see the aeroplane disappear into this Stargate structure. Nothing comes off the aeroplane, which is physically impossible when alloy hits something big like that. The engine pods would drop off, the tail would come off, the wings would probably come off, and yes, some of the aircraft would go in, but it would concertina, and it certainly wouldn't go the way it, when you look at it, it just disappears into the building. And when you freeze frame from another angle, you can actually see the aeroplane passing through the building, because the overlay of this false image wasn't done very professionally. And the other critical factor is when the nose cone of the plane strikes the building, there is an explosion on the nose cone. There's nothing in the nose cone to create such an impact or an explosion, because the fuel is way back in the fuel cells in the wings. So there's some pretty basic concerns from my point of view, but I'll give you something much more concrete in a minute, which will prove to you that this didn't happen. Anyway, back to you again, Steve.
Oh, well, I'm eager to hear it. We're going to have a break, bottom of the hour, Peter. We've got a few minutes. Take that amount of time and then go into this, the other information you have.
What, you want me to go ahead now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, there are multiple systems for checking the progress of aircraft. Please understand this. There is the conventional air traffic control, the airways control, the radar control. You've also got ground control. You've also got government statistics. You've got airport duty office statistics. And generally, there's all these interlocking ways of the government extracting the data. And even the airline itself submits a report, you know, the how many passengers went from that gate. The pushback time is monitored. The airport terminal manager knows all this when the planes are leaving. Air traffic control know. When the plane lifts off the runway, air traffic control knows. The airline knows. And other statistics. What happened this day, and a lot of people don't know this, there were two flights, two flight numbers, and two gates for the same flight number. Think about that. Two gates, two flight numbers, two flights leaving. One presumably may have had passengers on board, and another one could have been the fictitious one. We don't know. We don't even know if the passengers actually went on that particular plane. And when you get the liftoff times and you check with the various different systems, you'll find that there's huge discrepancies on passengers' numbers, on the passenger lists, on the pushback time, on the wheels off ground time, etc., etc. There was one discrepancy. Now the big one. What the authorities don't have any control over whatsoever is what the airline themselves put on their own aircraft. And there's a system called ACARS. Anybody can look this up, A-C-A-R-S. And this is an automated system of monitoring the health of the aircraft, the engines, the exhaust temperature, the fuel flow, and you can even SMS the crew through this system. This is a direct pilot to ground operations control. Now, guess what? When the American Airlines hit the first tower, that plane was still flying 20 minutes down the airlines, giving its automatic response back to base operations. So it could not have hit the tower because it was still flying. And how do they know that? Because when that aircraft transmits its data, it does so via the nearest relay station. So they know that this aircraft was close to a particular base station to be able to transmit that data. And it was nowhere near New York. And two of those aircraft were monitored in similar circumstances. So when you add that data in, and the discrepancies with all this data of the different authorities, which should, quote, be coordinated and agree 100%, which they didn't, and that there were two flight numbers for each flight, etc., plus the Shanksville thing, which was a false flag, plus the Pentagon, you can see that we can prove beyond the shadow of doubt that this was, you know, the greatest illusion ever performed.
Houdini, indeed, was more than one up, Peter. My goodness, if Houdini could be alive when this happened, I think he would have been in absolute awe to discover even a smidgen of the things that you discussed on the first half of this program and on a previous one. He probably would have, if he was still active in his profession, he probably would have retired because he couldn't match these magicians. He wanted to be the best, and he was surpassed.
Well, Stephen, as I told you, I spent my entire life, not only just on carriers, but also in civil aviation. I was an executive in operations. That put me in a very senior position. I had to work out flight plans and performances. I know exactly what an aircraft can do and cannot do, what fuel it's got, what it's capable of. And then when you add to that, there's a website called Pilots for 9/11 Truth. You must all go to that, because on there, you will read stories of United Airlines and American Airline pilots that flew the aircraft, and the ones that crashed, of course, whatever happened to them, and realize that, you know, these are the boys that really know the truth, as do I in being in aviation. So, you know, what I can't understand is all these years have passed by, why isn't the American public demanding that this goes to an independent inquiry?
Well, I think a lot of people have made a lot of demands, but of course they fall on deaf ears, and the scoundrel media, as I call them here, they absolutely won't say anything or nothing supportive of the truth. Their mission is to lie, not tell the truth. It's a breathtaking story. It's so important. Let's take a break, Peter. We'll come back. We'll talk about some other things. All the things, my goodness, we could spend the rest of the weekend and all of next week talking about a little bit of the things that happened post 9/11. But a quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. On with Peter Ayer. Spent the first half of the program talking about 9/11. There's so much else going on, Peter. Let's talk about some of the world events, maybe what you've been writing about lately. I focus an awful lot on the Middle East, and I know you go there as well as cover other things. But choose one of the topics that you've been writing about lately, and let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, of course, I had grave concern about the Goldstone report, which, as you know, the United Nations put Goldstone and a team of people to investigate if any war crimes or atrocities had taken place during Operation Cast Lead. I think it was 2008, 2009, which we can all remember. And of course, that was commissioned. It came off. It came back with a report which I thought was quite feeble. But anyway, nonetheless, it was a report. It did highlight atrocities and potential war crimes on the IDF side, and it was a little bit critical of some of the Hamas groups, etc. But it still fell short of what actually happened there. It gave no reference to the use of depleted uranium, which means that basically they nuked the entire Gaza Strip and their own territory as well, I might add. They even nuked Israel. There was no mention of that. There was a little bit of reference to white phosphorus, but not at the level that they should have taken it, much further. There was no mention of the flechette weapons, which are shells and bombs that emit thousands of tungsten darts that can penetrate concrete into a major city centre. And of course, consequently, many young children had these darts embedded in their shoulder blades and what have you. And it gave no reference to DIME, dense in a measure explosion, which sends little small cube pellets of tungsten and other nasty substances that literally pepper your face and arms wherever it strikes. None of this was raised in the Goldstone report. And then, having presented it to Congress, there was the usual Zionist control, where this report was kicked out lock, stock and barrel. And then when it eventually went to the UN, guess what? America vetoed it. And so the whole thing was a non-event. That is of grave concern to me.
Well, I agree that the Goldstone report could have gone much further than it did. At the same time, Peter, and I wrote quite a lot about the Goldstone report, not just when it came out, but follow-up articles as well. And there were some pretty strong quotes in it. But at the same time, Judge Goldstone had the audacity to also point fingers at Hamas. This was a preemptive, non-provoked attack by Israel on Gaza. Oh, there's a story that led up to what happened. Israel killed Gazans. There was a truce ahead of the Cast-Lead war. There was a truce. It was observed one-sidedly by Hamas and the other resistance groups in Gaza. Israel repeatedly broke the truce. They committed crimes in Gaza. And finally, there was maybe one major event, or maybe a couple, where a number of Palestinians were killed, maliciously killed by Israeli attacks, and that was it. And Hamas basically called the truce off and responded to one of them. This is the way Israel provokes a conflict. They will be the belligerent. They will finally get the other side to respond, which is their right to do in self-defense. And then the victim will be blamed. In this case, the Cast-Lead war was planned. Israel unleashed it. Oh, you're so right, Peter. They always test new weapons when they go to war, and they tested some new ones in the Gaza war. There are still weapons. I'm not certain if we even know what they are. But doctors reported, and I wrote about this, and I had one on my program. It's been so long I can't remember his name offhand, but he spent time in Gaza treating injured Gazans who survived. And he said he saw injuries like he never saw before in his work. He came from one of the Scandinavian countries. He never saw these injuries before, couldn't identify exactly what caused them, but he wrote about them. He wrote a book about them, and we talked about his book, and I wrote about the weapons that were used, the white phosphorus and the dime weapons and the other stuff. Israel used and depleted uranium. I mean, chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons used against Palestinians, and Goldstone had the audacity to point fingers at Hamas for acting in self-defense. And of course, then we had other commissions that followed Goldstone, and Goldstone retracted finally what he said. He pulled his punches back afterwards. After they beat up on him and what he did say, he pulled back And he basically apologized to Israel for what he did. He shouldn't have apologized. He should have laid it on more and said, well, I just didn't do enough in my original report. Here's a revised edition. Let me tell you what really happened in Gaza. And after the investigation that he and his team conducted over a number of days and weeks, they knew what happened. They knew enough about what happened to tell the dirty story. This was very, very ugly. The blame goes 100%. 100%, not 99.9, 100% to Israel. Hamas deserves no blame whatsoever, not for the other attacks. And when they respond to something, shoot a rocket or something, which is homemade, nothing compared to Israel's weapons, they always respond after multiple provocations. They do it in self-defense, and you can quote international law, and it says that is their legal right to do it. They're not committing a crime. They're defending themselves. Well, I'm on the Israel story all the time. I drafted a new article on Israel, Palestinians living under Israeli state terror. I'll get out tomorrow, Peter, so that's a timely topic for me. I go back to Israel-Palestine all the time.
Well, of course, I actually submitted my own UN report, a formal document, which was a very professional one. I sent it to the UN team in Geneva before they set out. They did not acknowledge my document, and for a submission, you always get acknowledgement, and I didn't get acknowledgement, so just to force them into doing this, I resent my submission a second time to every department in Geneva, including the Red Cross, including the Red Crescent, and I highlighted in there that the UN, quote, had not acknowledged receipt of my submission. Within 24 hours, I got an acknowledgement, because I'd embarrass them into doing it. But anyway, I highlighted the issues there. But where the public have to understand this, there's two issues going on here. Why did Israel go into Gaza at all? And it's a false flag, because the true reason for going in, and I've got the records to prove it, more than records. First of all, there was a massive gas find by British Gas close inshore in Gaza waters, in the Gaza Marine Reserve. Two massive fields and some that staggered the border. The guy in charge of the IDF made a statement to the Knesset saying that we have to attack Gaza and take out Hamas, quote, before we can drill for the gas. That is why they went into Gaza. But it didn't work. It failed. Because there was international outrage, and Hamas wasn't so easy to take out, because, believe it or not, the IDF had got a lot of reservists in there, and you know the IDF is made up mainly of very young reservists, no battle experience whatsoever, and just like when they went into Lebanon, they came out with their tails wagging. In this particular case, they were no match for Hamas. Yes, of course, the tanks went in, and the helicopter gunships went in, and Hellfire missiles and JDAMs, you know, all this sort of massive firepower, but the heroic, you know, soldier-to-soldier fighting never happened. And it's a good job it didn't, because they would have been annihilated. Because these Hamas people are, you know, they know their territory very well. It's like the guerrillas, you know, the Viet Cong. Look at the firepower we put into Vietnam. And look how we came out with our tails wagging, and that was a false flag anyway. So that was the true reason for going into Gaza. Please understand that. Back to you again, Steve.
Well, I do know about the gas find off of Gaza, and the gas find goes up off the coast of Lebanon, where it includes a Palestinian and Lebanese territory. And I don't know where that stands now, Peter, but I do know there has been a dispute that I have written about. It's been a good while, a dispute between Lebanon and Israel over who has ownership of those resources. And there were some very strong statements made by the Lebanese government that they simply won't tolerate Israel going in and stealing their gas, and with his gas there's oil, or with his oil there's gas. And, you know, they'll find out how much when they finally go after it to start drilling. But there is enough to matter to make it have some considerable value, and that absolutely was a big issue. There is a belief also, and I think it may be true, that Israel wanted Hamas to become the elected government of Palestine. There was no divided government. There was no Gaza government, West Bank government. In January 2006, Hamas won a convincing victory. I don't think the election had to be rigged to get them to win it. Fatah was so corrupted, so despised for what they did for so long that the Palestinians just wanted to get rid of them at all costs. So Hamas won the election very convincingly. I wrote about it a number of times. Nobody recognized them. Israel isolated them from the start. The blockade didn't go in right away. Went in close to 18 months later, June of 2007. And since from June 2007 to now, there's been an illegal blockade on Gaza, land, sea, and all borders sealed off to try to keep Gaza as isolated as possible. But my thought was possibly Israel wanted Hamas to be the government of Palestine so they could make all kinds of false claims about Hamas, call them a terrorist organization. At the behest of Israel, the U.S. State Department declared Hamas a terrorist organization. It is nothing of the sort. It is a legitimate, democratically elected government, even if Israel rigged the game to make sure they were elected. But that's the way the dirty game is played. Of course, we have the Cass-led war, December 2008, January 2009. 3 weeks or so of absolutely horrific violence, and so much construction is yet to be done. But Hamas gave Israel a convenient punching bag. That's what they did. I mean, they claimed all kinds of false stuff, a supposedly assassination attempt, or maybe it succeeded in London before the 1982 Lebanon War. I mean, that was a lot more horrific than Cass-led. Maybe 17,000, 18,000, mostly Palestinians living in Lebanon, were murdered in cold blood, including a few thousand in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps, with Ariel Sharon letting his phalangist allies go in unmolested and murder these people in cold blood. Ariel Sharon was defense minister at the time. Amazingly, he was chastised for that. He was criticized in America, criticized in Israel. Sure never happened much after that. But this dirty game goes on and on and on. And I talk about the Israeli tail, Peter, wagging the American dog. And I wrote about it again in my article today and in another one. I write so many, I forget what, I've got a few I haven't gotten out yet because I get ahead of myself, and I forget I wrote about it in one that did go out, but I have still another one that I may have said something about in it, but I haven't gotten that one out yet. But I mentioned it again in an article that will go out tomorrow, and it's shameless. Of course, it's a pre-election here in America, Pete. I want to let you get back in. It's pre-election. There's a little bit less than 2 months to go before our November 6th election. And the party platforms and the candidates, they're falling over themselves, declaring fealty to Israel. I mean, my God. Of course, yeah. AIPAC is a powerful influence. The other 50-odd Zionist organizations are powerfully influential. AIPAC is the best known. But there are 50-odd numbers of them. Zionist Organization of America, the oldest one, goes back to the 19th century, Anti-Defamation League, about a century old. These are vile, disgusting organizations.
Well, I think the problem is here, the American public don't understand how politics works in America or anywhere else in the world, and the Zionist mafia control. I say Zionist mafia because you and I know that there are genuine, sincere Jewish people, especially the original dwellers of Palestine, who are genuinely sincere, caring people. And then you've got these elements that came out of the Caspian Sea area, I call the Mafia Zionists. And what people don't understand is that when the Brits messed this up and handed this control over and created the state of Israel, that the chief rabbi at the time never wanted a country. He never wanted Israel to exist, and even he quoted in the Torah that they were not to have their own land. They were a free-floating organization like anywhere. Yes, you can have a center for your religion, like Mecca and all these other things, and Rome for the Catholics, but it was never intended to have a standalone nation. And there are many, many people now, especially in America, and lots of rabbis, I've even met them at a conference in London, that detest the mafia Zionists that are causing this bad taste you know, for the normal, healthy Jewish religion. So that's one thing. The second issue is, and this is so sincere, and I've tried, because I treat everyone equally, including on the Israeli side. I've got friends in Israel. I've got a very good friend in Haifa. Do the people in Israel understand that their government and the IDF, when they went into Lebanon in 2006 and then in Gaza 2008 and 9, using these weapons that were dirty bombs, depleted uranium, also possibly cold fusion, all experimental bombs, that they actually nuked their own dwellers. They nuked the northern part of Israel when they did Lebanon, and when they did Gaza, they nuked central and southern Israel. And I've got a picture of two JDAM bombs going off and two more coming in with this massive inferno. And if anybody is observant, like I am, because I used to be in military intelligence in NATO, you can see that there's a strong sea breeze blowing because the white tops of the waves. And that means that the photographer that took that photograph on Israeli territory, within 2 minutes, would have been encapsulated in this radioactive fallout. And the people of Israel don't know this. The infertility rate is dropping dramatically, or rising, I should say, which means they can't have children. The cancer rates are going way out of control. Why don't the people of Israel revolt and say, why is this happening? We don't want a cure for cancer. We want to stop the problem, depleted uranium and other nuclear weapons that they're using in the field.
Well, I certainly agree, Peter, and I could say the same thing about America, that there is so much harm done to Americans, extraordinary harm, and it seems to get worse and worse and worse. And the only thing that's happened, which is a wonderful movement, but it hasn't gained the kind of traction that it needs to have, and that's the Occupy Wall Street movement. It's the first real activism in America since the 1960s, but it doesn't come anywhere near up to the level of what came in during that period, a combination of civil rights protests and anti-Vietnam War protests, and Occupy Wall Street has light years to go to begin to approach what those two movements did, and they got results. They haven't kept the results, but they got them, and they got them by great pressure. It was sustained over years and years and years. The anti-war stuff went on from the mid-60s or earlier, right to the mid-70s. I mean, it took all those years to get that war ended, and finally Congress did something, whether it was because of the protests. I think it was because of a combination of a lot of things. It certainly wasn't because of the persistence of the Southeast Asians, the Vietnamese mainly, fighting for their liberation. And even what they fought for and won at that time is now all lost because they've surrendered to U.S. neoliberalism, another story. So they won the battle and they lost the war after fighting 30 years, all in vain, all in vain. But again, dirty stuff, and it goes on and on. Republicans and Democrats, the same agenda.
I'd like to come back to the Occupy movement in a minute, but just before we leave Gaza, the American public have to understand that not now, but then, the means of getting U.S. weapons to a particular area was done by what they call a transmittal notice. So if you want to send 2,000 bunker busters to Israel, it has to go through Congress in a transmittal notice. They declare where it's going, what it's for, and then the final signatory, depending on the status of the weapons, if they're WMDs, which bunker busters are, it's the president, the supreme commander, that puts a signature to that transmittal notice. Right? So just prior to Casled, all these stockpiles of these DU weapons were sent, compliments of America, to Israel and used in Gaza. Now, that is in violation of the export rules appertaining to weapons, because when you dispatch it, you have to know what they're being used for, and you would never put pen to paper to use depleted uranium in a densely populated city like Gaza. So there's the first downfall. What's happened now is your military and your president has now changed the ground rules. Now they're bypassing Congress. And what they do is they've created a depot, a U.S. depot in Israel. And so now they're doing a transfer of American weapons from an American depot, military depot in the U.S., to their American depot in Israel. But in brackets, can be used by our allies as and when required. So now they're passing all these dirty weapons without any signatory whatsoever. So that's that aspect of it. Now we're running out of time as usual. It's been a very quick hour. Let's come back to the charities, because I'm deeply involved in this. The first one is the Occupy movement. Very authentic, genuine people. But as one would expect with all charities, it's been hijacked. It's been hijacked by the New World Order. And it's funded by a main player in the New World Order, Mr. George Soros. So that's one thing. So that's one issue. So you look at that with an open mind. It was genuine. It still is genuine. But it has another evil overtone to it. Now, we come to the Free Gaza movement. Unknown to you guys, I was privy to going to Cyprus on behalf of the Free Gaza movement to crew a vessel, the Free Gaza boat itself, which was going to be given to the Palestinians as a gift. And I was crew member of that boat. There was also the Spirit of Humanity, and I was in Larnaca for a couple of weeks. I listened to the briefs. I saw what was going on. We were not allowed to film or record any of the briefs. But of course, with my intel background, little Peter Eyre had his recorder underneath his shirt. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And so I found myself with genuine people once again, but also I found myself in amongst a den of Mossad operatives or double agents. And I can vouch for this. So my boat sprung a leak and I didn't make it. I was trying to crew the next boat and they wouldn't let me on. I knew why they didn't want me to go, because I'd got a personal brief for the Gaza government on what was going on from the outside perspective, i.e. the oil and gas and all the weapons used, etc. So I didn't get it, and I came back. I was billeted with an agent. I went on board the ship. I exited the hotel for my own safety, because I didn't feel comfortable. I slept on the deck of the Free Gaza, and I was followed by more operatives, and they slept alongside of me. So I never got away from them. There was no better man happy to get back to England than myself after that event. But the other thing that I arranged, and this was vital, I managed to get a sample from a crater, a radioactive sample, out of Gaza. It took me 2 years. I intercepted an express train in James Bond mode and got it to a professor here to be tested. And so now you know my involvement in Gaza was more than an average guy would do.
Peter, I never knew that. I wrote about the Free Gaza boat. I wrote about a number of the humanitarian missions. I had no idea that you were personally involved in them. Oh, my goodness, we are out of time.
Steve, I've got the flag, the Palestinian flag, off the boat in my room, and I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, my goodness, what a wonderful thing to have. I wish I had one. Peter, I look forward to getting you back when you settle down after your travels. We will keep in touch. I know you'll keep me up to date. Again, I look forward to having you back so much. The hour went by much, much too fast. Before signing off, I'll just remind my listeners that we're on every Friday now instead of Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and weekends, Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.